The challenge illegal fishing poses to Australia was on display again in recent days in Darwin when two illegal Vietnamese fishing boats were torched after they were found with 200 giant clams on board. Now, these are clams that sell for up to $5,000 each. Australia has had a policy for some time now of burning the wooden boats that are found fishing illegally. But that policy was brought into question last month when an Indonesian fisherman was awarded compensation. The federal court in Darwin found that the Australian authorities were not justified in destroying his boat back in 2008. The lawyer who represented the fisherman is Greg Phelps. He's with us now. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Cameron.
I've also got with me James Fox, a professor at the Asia Pacific Program, and that's at the Australian National University. Hi, James.
Hi.
Greg, you represented Saring. Who is Saring?
Saring is a fisherman who has done nothing else in his life. He was based out of the fishing village of Osapa near Kupang in West Timor. He had fished for about 14 years with the boat that he had owned and had built. Brand new at the time that it was apprehended and burnt.
So what happened back in 2008 that led to the vessel being burnt?
Saring was fishing under Indonesian fishing licence. He was actually in the Indonesian fishing zone, and he was apprehended by the Australian authorities for suspicion of fishing for trepang, which is a bottom-dwelling species which attaches itself to the Australian seabed, which we claim rights to. So even though we're in Indonesian fishing waters, we say that we have the rights to the seabed, and therefore Saring was not entitled to fish for trepang.
And trepang's also called sea cucumber sometimes, I think.
That's correct, yes. It's a high-value food for the Chinese market, predominantly.
Okay, so this gets a little confusing. The waters belong to Indonesia, but the seabed, where Saring was, belongs to Australia.
That's correct. And in fact, the waters belong in Indonesia. Saring is entitled to fish for the fish swimming in the water, but not to take what we call under our legislation sedentary species from the bottom. Mm.
What happened when he was apprehended? How was he questioned?
He was, at the time, he hadn't even fished. He was actually floating around trying to fix a broken engine in his boat. The Australian boat came alongside, they boarded it, and they asked him, the Australians were not able to speak the Indonesian language, so the communication was, Saring wasn't able to speak English, and the communication was conducted through a set of plastic translation cards that asked questions about fishing. However, there was a flaw with those cards in that the questions related to matters that might arise if he were in Australian waters, but as it happened, the questions weren't appropriate for a fisherman in Indonesian waters.
Okay, but he was detained?
He was questioned. They searched his boat. They made the decision to destroy the boat. They made the decision first to take Saring on suspicion of an offence. The Navy looked at the boat and decided it wouldn't survive being towed 600 kilometres back to Darwin by a high-powered Australian naval vessel. And given that, they decided to burn the boat on the spot and take the crew on board and take them back to Darwin.
And Saring was what, ultimately released?
He was charged, but then at a later point, the charges were withdrawn because the authorities decided that more likely than not, he hadn't committed an offence.
So what's happened to Saring since his boat was destroyed in 2008?
Well, he's been rendered without a business. That was his sole business. He tried to get employment as a crew member on fishing boats, and that's the fishing up there has not been running that well recently. He then dabbled in taking a job to be the skipper on a illegal boat, bringing people on behalf of others, on behalf of the organisers, and he was apprehended this time in Australian waters as the skipper of an illegal boat.
People smuggling? Involved in people smuggling?
Involved in people smuggling. He was held for a period again of some months and then returned to Indonesia.
So how significant is it that he has won compensation in this case just last month?
Well, it's incredibly significant for him. I mean, his compensation of $25,000 will buy him a nice new boat. It will put him back into the business of being a fisherman, and he will, with the intervening six years, he'll be able to resume life as a small businessman operating out of Osava.
How common is it for Australian authorities to burn wooden fishing boats?
Back then it was much more common. I just heard you introduce about the Vietnamese boats, and that's the new thing at the moment. But back in 2008, there was a run on our authorities picking up boats. Some of them were in Indonesian waters, some were in Australian waters. We don't have an issue so much with boats being stopped and apprehended in Australian waters if they're breaking our law, but our point is that when fishermen are operating in Indonesian waters, a great deal of care needs to be taken to ensure that we're not breaching their rights.
What does this case and the compensation awarded to Saring, what does it potentially mean for other fishers who may have had their boats burned?
The claim that we brought in the court covered 10 boats for 6 fishermen. But when we started that claim, it was decided between ourselves and the Commonwealth that it would be prudent to run a test case, and the test case was Saring. So behind Saring stands another 9 fishing boats that we became aware of and that we joined in the claim. It is probable that there are a number of other boats taken around the same time that have the same or a similar fact scenario to Saring. So there might be an entitlement that we could argue for those people as well, but they're unknown to us at the time because the collection of that data is quite difficult and requires spending time actually up in a rather remote and third world area of the region.
Greg Phelps is the lawyer who represented the Indonesian fisherman called Saring. I should point out that we invited the Australian Fisheries Management Authority to take part in today's story. It declined that opportunity, saying Saring's case is still open to appeal. Professor James Fox is with me from the Asia Pacific program at the Crawford School of Public Policy, that's at ANU. James, generally, not just in Saring's case, but generally, why do Indonesian fishermen find themselves straying into Australian waters?
First of all, in some cases, they're allowed to fish in Australian waters. Going back to 1974, Australia signed a memorandum of understanding with Indonesia to allow traditional fishermen access well into Australian waters. And the area defined in which they can fish and gather tripang is called the MOU box. The box itself includes Ashmore Reef and extends all the way down to Scott Reef, far further to the south.
So is this recognition of the cultural importance to some of these people of fishing?
This was, in fact, back in 1974, a recognition of the fact that Indonesian fishers were using Australian waters, the reefs between Australia and Indonesia, as an important fishing ground. Mm-hmm. Now, I might say that at the moment for tripang, there are up to 70 boats that come each year to gather tripang at Scott Reef. And that's allowed, monitored, and goes more or less without a hitch.
Mm-hmm. So there are areas where the Indonesian fishermen are allowed to fish for tripang, but where Saring was picked up was not in that MOU box,
no,
as it's called.
That's to the north of the MOU box, and it's generally called the joint jurisdiction area because both Indonesia and Australia hold rights over it, Australia over the seabed, and Indonesia still has rights, fishing rights in that area. Mm.
So these traditional fishermen, surely it's their obligation to make sure they stay in their territorial waters and do not conduct the type of fishing they are not allowed to in Australia's territorial area.
That's the theory, and generally it works. It works. The difference, and this is actually a very big difference. Traditional fishing is defined as fishing whereby the fishermen must come in sailing boats. However, in the joint jurisdiction area, the fishermen, for example, the fishermen from Oisapa, will come in motorized vessels.
Why is that important, an important distinction?
Well, in 1974, when they were searching for a way to define traditional, and then there was a separate letter some years later that clarified it, traditional access into Australian waters, into this MOU box, was defined in terms of the boats used. Mm-hmm. And that has remained to this day, so that those fishermen, say, who sail all the way down to Scott Reef, come in traditional sailing boats.
Is there an argument that if you're in a traditional boat, it is harder to be absolutely certain where you are and if you are fishing in the correct place?
No, I've lived with these fishermen for many years, off and on. I would say... without exception, they're skillful navigators, and they're those who come in the sailing boats know exactly what they're doing. I'm always amazed at their skills.
So it's you couldn't really argue it's an innocent mistake if a traditional fisherman is picked up doing what they should be not be doing in the wrong spot.
There can be extenuating circumstances. Currents and other things that may take you a little ways off, but on the whole, the fishermen know what they're doing. Now, having said that, many fishermen will use the MOU box as a point from which to enter Australian waters, look for example, those looking for shark will sail into Australian waters where there are more shark, and then return into the MOU box, and it's a cat and mouse game.
Okay, so it gets quite complicated quite quickly. The Australian policy of burning boats, how effective has it been to deter illegal fishing?
I don't know how effective it was, and the policy has varied from time to time. I've been looking at these things back to the early 90s, and for a while, the policy was to bring all the boats in, and you would have a couple dozen illegal fishing boats, or those who are accused of illegal fishing, tied up in Darwin Harbor. There was an attempt to make a point and burn boats that had been seized along Darwin Shore. Films were made of that and sent back to Indonesia. I don't think that had much effect. But as I hear it from the Saring case, what happened was that the Navy judged that the boat would fall apart and could not be towed back. It wasn't obviously not one of the best boats, and as a consequence, they had little choice.
Greg Phelps, you're part of the Australian Lawyers Alliance, a member there that recently wrote to the federal government about the treatment of Indonesian fishermen. Why should the federal government take a more lenient or compassionate approach to illegal fishers, especially those that might also have dabbled in people smuggling?
Well, Cameron, we don't say it's necessarily a lenient approach that's required. We say that they should get it right, that we're at the interface of two nations there on this marine border, and when you're dealing with these fishermen's rights, and particularly if you're going to sail into waters where they are licensed under their own law, there should be great caution. And we should be getting it right rather than taking a heavy-handed approach and getting it wrong. There's a capacity to generate a lot of goodwill between the two countries, but instead of that, we seem to be just continually having it fester as a problem area where if we were more cautious and more respectful, perhaps, of their rights, then we we say that it could be a plus to the relations between Australia and Indonesia rather than a problem.
Mm. James, the illegal fishing is still seen as a serious problem here in Australia, and there are reports that quite organised groups based from China are operating in Australian territorial waters. Is there an argument that perhaps there should be a distinction made between dealing with smaller Indonesian fishermen from small villages versus what might be called more organised activity?
I think there already is. The offence is classified according to the kind of boat you're using, and it isn't just Chinese illegal fishers. The Indonesian fleet, a motorized large vessel fleet, has almost continuously been fishing illegally in Australian waters, and that's constantly patrolled.
AFMA's said in a statement that burning boats is the best deterrent but also needed for biosecurity concerns. Is that a fair argument?
It could be. The biosecurity, I think the best argument might be biosecurity, but again, then almost all the burning should be done well away from the Australian coast.
Well, Australia's relations with Indonesia is always an interesting topic. Thank you for joining us today to explore it in the area of fisheries and fisheries control. Thanks a lot, James.
Okay, thank you.
James Fox is a professor at the Australia Pacific Program at the Crawford School of Public Policy. That's at the ANU. And Greg Phelps, thanks for joining us today as well.
Thank you, Cameron.
Greg is the lawyer who represented the Indonesian fisherman called Saring.